Good morning to our North American listeners, good afternoon to our European listeners, and good evening to our Asian listeners. Today is Wednesday, April 29th. I am David Rosberg, Chairman of Niagara Capital Partners. Niagara is the administrative manager of the Niagara Freedberg Global Macro Fund and the Niagara Legacy Fund, both of them feeder funds into the Freedberg Global Macro Hedge Fund. With me is Albert Friedberg, the portfolio manager of the Master Fund. Good morning, Al.
Good morning.
We'll conduct our call today as we usually do. I'm going to put some general questions to Albert to begin, and then we'll respond to any questions that listeners may have. If you have a question that you'd like to put to us, you may do so by emailing it to erotp@niagaracapital.ca. That's erotp@niagaracapital.ca. Okay, let's begin. Al, I think that we should start today with your big picture view. I think you'd agree that the focus has shifted away from the private sector, where it resided through most of 2008, now to the public sector, and specifically on the fiscal deficit and on the Fed's attempt to reflate. How are you looking at these two grand phenomena?
Okay. Good morning, everyone. The concern is now moving away from today's recession. In that, we're not saying that the global recession is really over. Probably the rate of descent has slowed down significantly. But the real concern now is the end game of today's recession. And the end game has to do with what governments around the world have done, hundreds of policy measures, almost all of them converging on governments spending enormous amounts of money, getting involved in every aspect of the economy, and what it does to the debt figures, the government debt figures, and government deficits. We're looking at enormous deficits. The IMF has recently estimated deficits for England, let's say, of 10 to 11% of GDP, for the U.S. of 11% of GDP. Our numbers back in the envelope is that the U.S. will run the next 12 months something like a 20 or 21% deficit of GDP. That's unbelievably large, unbelievably large. And what it does first, in the longer run, it increases the vulnerability, the credit vulnerability of all these countries. Their debt as a percentage of GDP will double over the next 3 years. That's unprecedented. We only seen that during the probably the last war. And also it implies a much higher level of taxation. We've already seen in the UK that taxes are moving up. Marginal rates are going to be above 50%. I believe at the threshold of $150,000 a year. So we should be prepared for much higher rates of taxation in the U.S. and many other parts of the world to pay for this fiscal orgy. It's going to have very significant, in the medium term to long term, very significant impact on growth, on economic growth. I believe that unlike what happened when we came out of the weak 70s and early 80s, unlike what happened then, our levels of debt are substantially higher, private and public debt, and our level of taxation will be substantially higher, so that we're not likely to repeat the rates of growth that we had experienced in the 80s and 90s. So we're stuck with very low economic growth, and now we come to the shorter term picture, and I mean the next 18 months. And the question is, how will we fund this fiscal deficit? how will the government fund this fiscal deficit? And it's a very complicated picture. It's very difficult to fund this deficit at today's rates of interest when you have long-term rates hovering around 3% a year. It's very difficult to get that kind of financing coming out of this at those rates. It's unlikely that foreign governments will continue to accumulate debt at that rate, or at the rate that's necessary to fund this, at the rates of interest of 3%. So if the government wanted to fund it out of real money, it would have to see interest rates rise substantially. So our feeling is that over the next 18 months, perhaps 24 months, long-term rates will rise substantially, which itself will have an effect on the economy because it will increase the rate of savings and therefore decrease consumption and once again get a negative rates of growth in the economy, once again get a contraction or produce a contraction. The alternative to funding this deficit out of real money is that the Fed decides to monetize it. And that means that the Fed decides to actually buy, as they're buying now, they announced that they were buying $300 billion of treasuries, that they end up buying now most all part of that deficit, which in numbers, by the way, is $3 trillion, pretty close to $3 trillion. So we would have to step up the rate of purchases from $300 billion now to, I don't know, $1 trillion or $1.5 trillion or $2 trillion or whatever the amount is required in order to maintain what they think is an adequate rate of interest. That would have a significant impact on inflation longer term. Already now, the Federal Reserve balance sheet has expanded. It's gone up to about $4 trillion. Excess reserves in the system are around $700 billion. If the Fed were to monetize the rest of the deficit, we would end up with perhaps a Fed credit of $6 trillion, or close to that, or maybe more. And the excess reserves in the trillions. Now let's talk for a minute about excess reserves. These excess reserves have not been kept as excess reserves. The banking system has not been willing to use them either by making by actively increasing loans or by actively purchasing investments like treasuries or corporates. The reason may be a serious lack of confidence in the government and in the rules of the game. Lack of confidence in the rules of the game is probably the main reason. We're not very sure what the government wants and how it changes the rules. But it's only a matter of time before all that extra liquidity in the form of excess reserves will be put to work. And when it does, it will increase our money supply in the United States by very large numbers, more than double digits, and we can't really tell how fast that will increase. That will increase very rapidly. Once again, if at that point the Fed wants to mitigate that, and it wants to begin to absorb those excess reserves, it will need to sell securities, and it will need to increase rates. So in the process, it will need to increase rates. So all our thinking is converging on the following. A lower rate of growth in the medium to longer term. Much higher rates of inflation than we've had till now. Much higher rates of interest than we've had till now. And it's this scenario that we now have to think of this scenario as the end game of today's recession. So this is really the important thing. Other considerations that will create will add volatility to this market, of course, are I think they're well known, like now, for instance, the outbreak of the swine flu, which may or may not spread. It could remain dormant for months and then take on a new form and a more lethal form. The political situation in Asia, so for instance, the situation in Pakistan, a dangerous situation. There's a number of other factors that will make a difference, and probably all of them will signify or will imply that the governments will, that the Western governments will spend more money. So we are moving in the direction of spending more money and borrowing more money, and then you can ask yourself the question, where's the money going to come from? So that's the picture that we see going forward, rather than concentrating on short-term factors like GDP and earnings. I think that's the big picture. That's the important picture coming up. Let's speak first, if we could, about how this big picture view has affected the way you've positioned the portfolio, and then afterwards let's address some of the view in a more micro level. What changes have you made to the portfolio versus where you were at the end of the fourth quarter of 2008? What we have done is because again, now as you heard just a few minutes ago, we have a medium to longer term picture in place. It is becoming more difficult. It is difficult to know exactly when that kicks in. So in the short end, the market may be just moving mostly on technical factors. The market may have been oversold, and now it's correcting some of its oversold condition. There's a number of short-term factors that are clouding, or at least are making a lot of noise, and maybe masking the major trends. And so it becomes very difficult to trade in this kind of environment. Because you're still not there, you still haven't begun what we call the end game. So what we have done is since the end of the year, we have deleveraged a little bit the portfolio. We have smaller positions, tended to concentrate more. For instance, we have moved a little bit more towards increasing our exposure to our hedge program in equities, where we are long and short, and we're looking at not global macro elements, but perhaps more industry macro elements, and we consider that to be a program that should do relatively well under any kind of condition. We have maintained and feel that that's still a very interesting position. Is this position in inflation-linked securities, which we've seen in the past, let's say since the middle of March, an expansion of break-evens. That means that in effect, the market is sensing, is beginning to sense that we're going to have a major inflationary problem in the next few years. Just to let you know, for instance, that the five-year forward tip, with what it implies on a forward basis, it's already trading at 2.5%. It was below, in December last year, it was below 0.5% a year. So we like this position. We think that tips are going to be, the break-evens are going to continue to expand, inflation expectations are going to continue to build, and maybe we're going to see all-time highs on those levels, maybe 5, maybe 6, maybe 700 basis points. But we also want to be careful about that, because a general discontent with public debt will affect even inflation-linked securities. So we have to be careful. I believe that at some point, and it's not today, but at some point the break-even levels will be wide enough that it will not justify holding on to these, and then we'll have to get out of these and perhaps move some floating rate security. We have kept those. We have increased a little the equity edge. We have lowered a little bit our gold exposure. If only because, not because we are bearish, but because we think that it's still a fairly large, wide consolidation area, somewhere between 970 and 850. We have a very large consolidation range. It's what we call, in a technical parlance, we call it a high-level consolidation. In the real world, its counterpart is an absorption of supplies. Now, these supplies, incidentally, a lot of the supplies are coming in from scrap selling in the U.S. group, scrap. And many of you have seen these ads on television where they advertise that they can take your gold jewelry and they can give you cash. The amount of scrap coming in the market, I believe I saw recently that Goldfields had estimated that it was something in the area of 500 tons in recent months in the quarter. So that's a tremendous amount of gold. It is moving as we saw. It is moving into the hands of investors, and we can see that by looking at the ETF, and where we see the ETF holdings have increased by a few hundred tons. So there's a shift. There's a lot of selling, scrap selling. There's still some selling, minimal selling by central banks. We've seen that starting to dry up. And of course, there's been a bit of a drop in jewelry purchases because of the price. But the market is adjusting, consolidating and adjusting to these new levels. We are now approximately 1 year into this consolidation, and I believe that the next move comes up, which should be fairly soon, we're going to break out of this range and going to go up. Our next target will be somewhere in the area of $1,300, $1,400. So, as I say, our position is a little smaller, and we've reduced it a little bit. The carry is still carry. It costs us some money to carry it, and the nervousness in the market makes it difficult to. In other words, we've adjusted the position so that our day-to-day volatility does not increase too much, but we are ready to increase it to its maximum to the maximum exposure that we want on strength, actually on strength rather than on weakness, on strength. To us, those are key positions. We decreased a little bit our currency trading, which hasn't been very good. We have also, and this is important, our last main point, decreased our own commodity trading, which was not really commodity trading, but it was futures trading, in favor of a view that what we need now is a way to bet on rising international commodity prices. And let me just make a quick point here. When people speak about inflation, and when we speak about inflation, well, I think we're speaking about two different things, and actually we're speaking about three different things. When people speak about inflation, they speak about probably the CPI. That's what they're speaking about, and that's what they're talking about. And probably some anecdotal evidence that they have that their transistors or their internet accessory equipment or any of those kind of things have gone down in price. Maybe iPods have gone down in price, I don't know. But when we think about inflation, we think about two things. One of them is monetary inflation, and in the long run, monetary inflation is what actually drives price inflation, and sometimes with a long lag, it could be a lag of 1, 2, or 3 years. So that's one thing. So we say that there is a lot of inflation in the system. We mean there's a lot of money being created, a lot of money being printed in simple language. The second thing that when we refer to inflation, we also refer to inflation in international commodities. And those are heavily traded commodities that are denominated in U.S. dollars, but that are that are affected not just by a labor situations in the United States or some other country, but are affected by demand in many different places. And so, and not only demand, but also by supply factors. In recent years, many countries have instituted very negative policies when it comes to supply. And Argentina is an example. It's going to be planting. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Argentina is going to be planting, for instance, less wheat this year than in the last 50 or 70 years. Government interference, you know, export controls, so price controls. Oil production is flattening outside of OPEC simply because governments have taken control of those resources, and government, as we know, government is not a very good operator. And examples of this sort we find everywhere, environmental concerns when it comes to mining. So that supply is affected on a global basis, and so is demand affected on a global basis. So when we speak about inflation, we also refer to international commodity prices. And so our feeling is that the way forward is going to be one in which we're going to see substantial inflation in for instance, commodity prices. And for us to participate in this market, we need to have exposure to a variety of commodities. And to that effect, I have chosen a CTA that we know very well, who is very capable, and who's got a very robust technical system that principally knows how to, not only how to get in, but knows how to get out, and that's important. And we have said to him, look, we want you to build up a position in commodities on the long side. And he's begun to do that, and to our satisfaction. And I think that that's going to be, going forward, a very interesting source of profit for the fund. So basically, this is something where we have gotten ourselves of that area, and instead given it over to somebody who has probably a better handle on the market liquidity and on he has a better handle on how to get out of these markets when we need to get out. And so our view is, let's go long. We want to be long commodities, you do it. When we decide that that we want to be out, we'll just liquidate those positions. I'll ask them to liquidate those positions.
You got the commodity position not including gold.
Right. Everything but the position of gold, correct. That's basically what we've done. As I said, the overall net effect is that we have actually deleveraged the fund, and we are now probably at the smallest leverage. I believe that now we're probably trading at the lowest leverage ratio in probably a couple of years. Yet we still continue to have some very interesting positions going forward.
What would you think might be a trigger for a more aggressive leveraging?
Well, we want to see those medium to longer term trends that we are forecasting. We want to see them beginning to take place, and when they do, they will last for some considerable time. And so we believe that we can get on this bandwagon and ride it.
I want to talk a little bit about the, I think our listeners would like to know some of the sectors, the industry sectors that you're trading in the equity hedge program. But before we get to that, we've had a number of people email us asking your view on the dollar. There's been a lot of talk about a breakup of what's so-called, what's been called Bretton Woods 2. There's a lot of concern about the dollar's place in the world. With its quantitative easing, you found the currency environment, as you just said, challenging in the first quarter. What's your view on the dollar?
Well, the important thing to consider when it comes to currencies is that we don't trade absolute. We don't trade absolute magnitudes. In other words, it's not as if the U.S. We're not saying the U.S. is virtuous if we go long the dollar. So we're saying that the U.S. is more virtuous, relatively speaking, than someone else. So in this environment, it's difficult really to say who is more virtuous than anybody else. I mean, everybody's doing crazy things. Everybody's overspending. Everybody's spending money like crazy. Where then are the majority of these loose capital flows, which amount to trillions of dollars, where are those flows going to go? And in the end, for now at least, the U.S. remains a better place to invest money because of the depth and liquidity of its markets and still the legal framework in the U.S. is stronger than in most other countries. So it still remains an attractive place, relatively speaking. My view is that at least in the very short term, the dollar is still going to be stronger. That this is not a medium term or long term forecast because the U.S. continues to run a very large current account deficit, and international debt continues to increase. So what the U.S. is looking at is foreign debt that is beginning to overhang over it. And there's a very large amount of debt that's overhanging the U.S. And this debt is subject to spasmodic sales or liquidation. It's possible at some point in time some of these countries will decide to sell or to freeze at least the holdings. Something similar happened to the pound in the early part of the century when there were the pound was the largest was the international currency, and its debt was very widely held, and as it continued to run deficits, the desirability to hold these balances diminished, and we ended up with a problem, the problem of the overhang of this, of these sterling balances, and this produced a slow downward pressure on sterling, and sterling, as you know, was devalued substantially from over 4 to the dollar to something like at the time 250, and then ended up going below that too, and now it's of course less than that. So the dollar balances are today extremely large, the international dollar balance are extremely large. They will slow any kind of rise from Iran and eventually put downward pressure on the dollar. When? I'm not sure.
Thank you. Let's turn briefly to the equity hedge pocket. You've expanded its size in the fund, and you feel comfortable with some of the macro calls you've made on an industry basis. Can you talk about those a bit?
Well, we have some industries that we like better than others. Housing, we think, is an industry that has bottomed, and we have a strong position there. I believe that most of the companies in the housing sector have liquidated enough debt, have become leaner, much leaner than they used to be. Their inventories are down substantially, and most of these companies should improve going forward. So we have a very strong position there. We have a net long position now, net long position in the financial sector. Still some shorts and some longs, but net long, and our net long position is based on the fact that there are some players in the financial space that are doing
relatively well.
So that's still good. We've also increased a little bit our position in insurance, the life insurance sector, which has been very beaten down, and selling at very substantial discounts to its assets. I mean, it's still a question of what the assets are worth, but for the most part, they are liquid assets, and they have a price. They have a market price. They have better transparency in their portfolio than in most other financial industry players. So we like some of that. We have a number of different, and on the short side, there's no single sector. It's just a smattering of different companies. Companies that are large, that have a brand name of some sort, or that are cyclical and being affected in a big way. So,
What is it about brand names
brand names in an environment like today, it gets less of a premium over generics. People want to shop for cheaper goods. And then cyclical companies that are being squashed by what's going on. On the long side, we also like the biotechnology sector, the large biotechnology sector. It's done very well in this environment, and we think we'll continue to do well because they have products that the drug companies don't have, and the drug companies will need to purchase these or collaborate with them. So generally, we think that there is good dispersion. And that's what we need, dispersion. You know, we need to know that the market can advance, but it can go down, but it can have stocks, some that will go up a lot and some that will go down a lot, and we can take advantage of that. We think that there is dispersion, that it will be increasing in the next 6 months to 12 months.
On a global basis, you were short Venezuela in the form of a long held credit default swap you held on its debt. You've been active short property developers in Spain and financial institutions in Ireland. Where do you stand now globally?
Well, we have much smaller position. We did take profits in Spain and Ireland. And in the CDS area, we still maintain, although we liquidated some at better prices than as well as CDSs. We still believe that it's only a matter of time before Venezuela will default. And we still have another 7 or 8 years left in our CDS position, so we think that we have plenty of time. The market is very thin. It's not a place to really be. We have de-emphasized the credit default swap market because it's thin. There's no longer such a concern with counterparty risk, but really dealers' markets are very wide and not attractive for trading. But we have kept that, and we've also kept the position in Iceland, which we also purchased at good levels, and thinking that both of these will at some point default under debt.
I'm not going to take up much more of your time. I want to put to you a question that's been sent to us by a client. He asks you really to make to assign probabilities to a debate that is taking place at its polar opposites by David Rosenberg, the deflationist, and Alan Meltzer, who's more in your camp of calling for a lot of inflation being the result of the quantitative easing policies of the present administration. What odds would you assign if these two arguments were horses, what odds would you assign to their likelihood of winning in the next year?
I don't think that they are arguing. Their argument is a fundamental argument. I think that Rosenberg will agree to Meltzer's position, but the question is one of timing. I think Rosenberg's view is more affected by short-term considerations, the output gap, basically the output gap constraints on spending, constraints on income, the savings rate. Those are things that in the short run do shape what we call inflation rate, and this goes back to a point I made earlier on, that when we speak about inflation, we're speaking about many different things, at least three different things. And I think Rosenberg is right on that first part. I believe that it's clear labor costs are slowing down, unemployment rates are going up, and they're going to continue to put pressure on the wage rates. The output gap is going to continue to put some pressure on downward pressure on prices. Those are little temporary factors, and they're important when you're making a forecast, a six-month forecast, or even a year forecast. Maybe years already stretching it, but certainly a six-month forecast. They're important and they take precedence. But I don't think Meltzer is speaking about that. I think Meltzer is speaking about the terrible position which we put ourselves in, which is we are creating a monetary monster, and it's going to be very hard to rein in that monster. And that's what he's speaking about. He's concerned about the growth of money, the growth of reserves. And how that will be reabsorbed, if ever, or if it's possible to do so. So I don't think that there is a great difference between the two. Intellectually, I think David Rosenberg understands that well, and I believe that he would agree with Meltzer. So if you ask me, who's going to be right for the next 6 months? First of all, I don't think Meltzer has made a six-month forecast, so I can't tell you that there is a difference between these two. I think that Rosenberg has it right. I believe that domestic inflationary pressures are very subdued in the U.S. and will remain so for months to come, especially when unemployment rises. What happens subsequent to that, though, is an altogether different picture, altogether different thing. Just to remind you that in the late 60s, early 70s, we had a lot of excess capacity, rising unemployment, an output gap. We had the 70-71 recession. Things look very bleak, very, very bleak from the economic point of view. And actually, the pressures on wages were downward. Monetary factors caused an explosion in inflation in the late 72, early 73 that persisted for 7 or 8 years. So even though we had a fairly weak economy, it was not a strong economy at all, and even through the 70s, it was not a very strong economy. I think one of the lowest growth rates in a decade, in any decade in the U.S. history. And yet we had very high rates of inflation. So that's my long answer to that question. But it's a question that I think that we need to break it down a little bit to get the right answer.
Al, thank you very much. Thank you for your time this morning. On behalf of all the investors in the front, I wish you good luck for the rest of the second quarter. Thank you, David. Thank you, everyone. This ends our conference call for today. We will be posting it in the form of an audio file.